Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to React Roundup, and we have a great panelist episode for you this week. We have myself, Jack Harrington, as well as Paige Niederinghouse.
Hey, everyone.
And TJ Van Toll.
Hey, everybody.
And this week, we're going to cover a topic that I actually did in a video on my channel around advice for junior engineers from senior developers that will basically secrets that the senior developers have learned in their careers, mostly about kind of job stuff, kind of, or really anything, I guess. Keep it very open and just to help you out in your career.
Hey folks, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And lately I've been working on actually building out Top End Devs. If you're interested, you can go to topenddevs.com/podcast and you can actually hear a little bit more about my story, about why I'm doing what I'm doing with Top End Devs, why I changed it from devchat.tv to Top End Devs. But what I really want to get into is that I have decided that I'm going to build the platform that I always wished I had with devchat.tv, and I renamed it to Top End Devs because I want to give you the resources that are going to help you to build the career that you want, right? So whether you want to be an influencer in tech, whether you want to go and just max out your salary and then go live a lifestyle with your family, your friends, or just traveling the world or whatever, I want to give you the resources that are going to help you do that. We're going to have career and leadership resources in there, and we're going to be giving you content on a regular basis to help you level up and max out your career. So go check it out at topenddevs.com. If you sign up before my birthday, that's December 14th. If you sign up before my birthday, you can get 50% off the lifetime of your subscription. Once again, that's topenddevs.com.
And I'll start off. And the first thing I did in my video, the first one, first secret was, and this is actually, I think, the most controversial one, is that there are stupid questions. And I will preface that by saying there are questions you might want to think twice before asking. And here's my thinking on this. So if you ask a question that is easily Googleable or something that you can debug through, first off, and my daughter reminded me of this, you're missing an opportunity. You're missing an opportunity to learn how to Google, how to debug, how to actually work through the issue, how to read those error messages. I mean, sometimes all the information you need is in the error message and it just looks like a big bunch of blah, right? And learning how to parse through that, that's a good job skill. So don't deny yourself that opportunity. Give yourself, say, 15 to 30 minutes to kind of work through the opportunity if you're blocked. And then if you're still blocked at the end of it, not only will you have had the learning of trying to work through it, but you'll also have basically some material that you can present to whoever you're asking, saying, this is what I did. You know, here's the steps that it takes to get to the problem that I'm seeing. And here is what I tried to do to solve it. And that's a lot better than just kind of like throwing up your hands and saying, I don't know. And so, but it was controversial. I know a lot of folks out there have strong opinions about it. So I'm very interested. What do you guys think about this?
I second that. For me, it makes a lot of sense, exactly what you're saying. It's like, if somebody comes to me, another developer, and they have not tried anything yet, it feels kind of just like you're copping out. Like you haven't even given it a shot. Right. And
here, let me give you my problem.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you're supposed to be adding value to this team. And instead, you're just taking up somebody else's time without even having tried anything that you can say, you know, I tried XYZ, that didn't work. I tried ABC, that didn't work either. and you know, now I'm stuck. That I am so much more willing to help you because you've at least told me some things that you attempted that didn't work. So I can see which direction you're going. And then maybe we just need to reset and start going in a different direction. I mean, I've done that so many times where I've started going down one rabbit hole, and then at team check-in or something, I'll say, this is the direction I'm going. I'm hitting these roadblocks. And somebody will say something that is really obvious, but is completely not what I was thinking about how to solve the problem. And it makes way more sense and it works so much better. But if you can't even say that you've already tried a couple of things to, and this is the issues that you had, nobody's going to be able to really suggest something that makes more sense or is potentially a better solution because you haven't done anything that's worth commenting on yet.
Yeah.
Well, this applies for getting online help as well. Like if you use something like GitHub Issues or Stack Overflow or something like that, if you just dump a stack trace into a Stack Overflow post, you're not going to actually get anything that's going to help you out because no one's going to be able to know what that means unless unless your area is super obvious or simple.
Yeah.
What helps a lot more is if you can really understand what the issue is yourself before you try to take that next step. So some of that can mean you've done your due diligence and sort of searching around yourself, trying to Google the problem. It can also be trying to isolate the problem down to one small thing. So it's not working is not particularly helpful. If you can get down to one specific piece, I can for sure say that the problem is happening in this library or this line of code or this function is where things are going wrong. Well, all of a sudden you've taken a really big problem and made it into something that's more manageable for you to figure out and also easier to ask for help for, whether it's online or whether it's your coworker. So it's not that there's no stupid question. Well, I guess it is in a sense there is a stupid question, but it's more like, it's like anything else. If you're not prepared, if you don't do your work, you're going to get the return that you put into it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So much so. Yeah. You know, and the ability to say also, it was working until X, and then I did Y. Like, I bumped the version on this library, and then boom. Right? That, in particular, you know, that's one of those doctor, it hurts when I do this, don't do this things. Maybe not, but, or maybe we need it, you know, but try and work through those issues. But be able to understand like where it stopped working. I find a lot of people, and this is what I find in junior developers, is sometimes they get scared a little bit of running code, and it's easier just to write code than it is to run it and actually see the problem. And I really encourage folks to just write a little bit, run it, write a little bit, run it, write a little bit, run it, because if you write and then run, it's going to blow up and you're gonna be like, I don't know, could be anywhere in here. It's like I wrote 80 lines. It could be any one of those. It could be more than one bug. No,
I touched 10 files before I tried it.
Uh-oh. Right.
That's actually a good segue into one that I have continued to relearn as I have gone along in my career, which is commit the code when it works, not after you've decided to refactor it and you're kind of halfway through the refactoring. I did this couple weeks ago where I was trying to make my code cleaner and smarter, and I ended up breaking it for about 3 hours and couldn't figure out what I had done, and had to just go through the commits to figure and comment stuff out and finally get back to working.
You broke
up in the middle, so maybe just take it from like the top for like one other tip.
That's
I
a
ran
good
into
segue that leads into dang it, that was so good.
Okay.
Yeah, what's funny too is you cut off right off on like the cliffhanger too.
Right, like it was. We're like, what?
But you probably should take it from the top.
Sure.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. So another good thing that kind of segues into is something that I keep relearning as I go along in my career, which is to commit code when it works, not after you have refactored it and made it cleaner and smarter and more elegant. I did this to myself a couple of weeks ago where I was trying to make code that was already working look better and work nicer and be more flexible. And I broke my own code for about 2.5-3 hours and spent an afternoon kind of just commenting stuff out and looking back at old commits. And it was just a complete waste of time. And if I had just not put in those four lines or committed my code before I added them, it would have saved me a whole ton of time.
And you can commit before you push, right? You can commit locally a bunch of times, and you can even squash that commit before you push it up. So it doesn't look like it's one, like it's a bunch of commits. Yeah, I totally agree. Absolutely.
Yeah. But just being able to undo and figure out was working here. So what did I change in between now and then would have saved me a whole bunch of time.
I remember back in the day when I did Java development, the Eclipse-based framework that I was using had this concept of saving off like your session or like your state at periodic intervals. You know, like every 15 minutes, it would save all your files where they were at. And I remember at times, because the source control we were using at the time was some awful enterprise something, right? That barely were, there was no concept of commits. Things were not easy. Things were not very easy to use. So sometimes you'd run into this situation where it was like, well, crap, this was just working. What the heck changed? And then I found myself going into Eclipse's menu and go like, oh, well, let's see what was going on at 10:15, right? Jump back to that point in time. It was just the most god-awful process of going back to some random state of my app and see like saving off files to the desktop, right? And moving things around until you get things to work. So
you're like halfway through an if statement.
Yeah, exactly. So yes, exactly. Well, it kind of worked, but
really
so it's a long way of me saying I plus one, you know, commit, you can do it. Local commits cost you nothing. And then you have a point in time that you can always refer back to that you can push, you can merge, you can do whatever with, but at least it gives you that point in time to refer back to.
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes you're just so, you get so far down the wrong path that it just makes more sense to just throw everything away. So if you can go back to a state where it was working and then kind of approach it again, there's a very good chance that you can figure out a better way than the way you were going where everything stopped working.
And I would say I kind of commit in themes. It's like, okay, I just finished refactoring like the auth stuff, you know, and it works. And now I'm going to like refactor with the CSS, right? Or something like that. And it's like, and so once that theme is done and right. And then I do the CSS stuff. And yeah, that generally kind of nicely bucketizes things. It's like, oh, okay. That breakpoint of like that git commit, I can just roll back there. Mm-hmm. Now I'm at least got auth. It's like putting a piton on your rock climbing. Like, okay, I'm at least when I fall, I'm only going to fall this far. I'm not going to fall off the cliff and die.
Well, actually, maybe I can use that just to keep the theme going of a segue, because I think that touches on something that I've learned the hard way over the years. And that's whenever you're doing something like a big project, whether it's like a migration or some sort of giant project, to always look to ways so you can split that up into smaller problems. Mm. And that's both from a technical perspective, because if you try to be like, I'm going to refactor these 100 files, that can just be hard to do. If you're working on a team, that can also hold up the team because they're waiting for these 100 files to come in because you don't want to create all these merge conflicts or whatever. So we can throw your team into a mess things up, planning and whatnot as well. But it's also psychological as well, that seeing some progress, just pushing some things forward, just really helps you see the finish line. Because I've also over the years been part of projects like this that just never happened because someone would start going into it. You get 30, 40% of the way through it, and then some other production issue comes up, something that pulls you off of it or whatever. And that work you did for these couple of weeks just gets completely abandoned because you never get back to it. Whereas if you have an incremental plan, you can ship incremental points. You can find ways of getting out there. It can sometimes be a challenge to find these points, but it's, in my opinion, pretty much always worth trying to find something just because it leads to greater success. It's kind of where the whole part of how the whole agile methodology came about too, is it sort of embraces that sort of way of approaching problems.
And that works at the macro for the big projects, you know, as you say, like phase everything, right? You know, phase and have every deliverable at each phase make sense. But it also works at the micro level of like, if somebody gives you a challenging problem and you're like, man, I don't even know where to start with this thing. Mm-hmm. Like, take any point at which it's like, oh, well, first you need to read a JSON file. Okay, I know how to do that, right? That's one thing I can do. And you, as you say, you just get some momentum some going. Like, oh, now I've got, oh, wow. Okay. At least I've got some sort of traction. I guess 5% of this thing done. And then and commit that using Paige's point. And then move on to the next thing. Just keep on adding to it. And eventually you'll find that the size of the unknown gets to be like a 20-line block. You're like, okay, this is the real nut. I don't even know how to, something in there. But, at least you've got the stuff around it.
Yep.
All right. So another one from my video, I guess this is almost no good segue on this one, but show your value early. So what I mean by that is, you've gotten into a new job, you've gone past the interview, and you've gotten an offer and all that, and you've gotten on the team. And I think people think of that as like, okay, I'm done. Like, I've shown my, I'm ready. The team trusts me. No, they don't. Like, the team doesn't trust you until you've actually put code into production.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of these startups, they'll keep when you get on the team, they'll have a bucket of little issues change this line of text or move this button around, the kind of thing that takes an engineer who's been on the team for a while, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever, nothing. Mm-hmm. But it's going to give you an opportunity to go through the code base, get it installed, get it up and running, have a look around, find the thing, do the commit, go through CI/CD, go through code review. Get your butt kicked in the code review and then, get it out into production. And then that's going to give you that sense of one, I'm accomplished. I've actually done something on the team. And two, it's going to give the other folks that trust in you. And I think a lot of folks, when they get onto a team and they see that happen, they're like, oh my gosh, is this the segment? This is a interview part three. And it's no, they're giving you an opportunity to get that credibility. And so you kind of should grab onto that. And if the team doesn't do that, you come through the first morning stand up, you're like, hey, I'm Jack. Why? Nice to meet you. And they don't give you a bug, then say, hey, is there something that I can do? Is some little thing that I can just go and get into the code base right now? That would help me out a lot. And make that opportunity for yourself.
Yeah.
I think it's always also the best way to learn too, the whole trial by fire thing It's one thing to see tutorials on programming languages or whatever it is you're trying to learn, even tutorials that are domain specific to whatever it is you are working on. It's another thing to be thrown into a real problem, because then you have to actually learn the systems in a very real way. And that's going to stick, and that's going to help you more in the long run than working on something, I guess, a little more trivial or not super conducive to whatever it is you're working on. So I definitely agree. Good to get in on something real, bite off something, see what you can do.
Well, and one thing that I might recommend that's happened for me at two of my jobs that I've done programming wise is asked to pair with somebody who's been on the team or who knows that code base well, because not only do you start to get a feel for how the code is structured and what do we follow in terms of writing good code or writing for this particular code base, but you also start to get a feel for how do we make pull requests? Is there a specific pattern that we follow? Are unit tests a requirement of PRs? Do end-to-end tests figure into this? And you just get to ask the questions that you wouldn't necessarily get answers from.
In the flow of the conversation. You're building out the feature, you're like, oh no, I wouldn't do it that way, or we wouldn't do it that way. We'd do it this way. That will save you from that PR slamming of your first big PR goes in. They're like, whoa, this is not our. Well, if you've done the pair programming thing, you get that kind of as just part of the conversation.
Yeah. So you get to, you get to meet your coworkers a little bit more and get to know them. And you also get to see how development is done for this particular team. What kind of things are observed? Is this a particular style of architecture, clean architecture? Do we care much about testing at all? Maybe we don't. But you kind of just get a feel for that, as well as being able to contribute and learn and kind of bounce ideas off of one another. So if that is an option and you're not like the only developer just joining somewhere, definitely try and do that, because it's immensely helpful for me, at least, to get going faster and feel like I'm being a useful member of the team a lot earlier.
It's the one exception to that kind of there are dumb questions rule one of those environments where you're doing that pair programming. It's just so rapid fire. Don't even worry about like respect or whatever. You're going to meet the person's kids as they come in the room, and they're going to be like jumping around. It's just a good time. Just don't worry about it. You know, mistakes are fine. Yeah. If you can do that, that is a great way to get on a team. It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess one like corollary to there are stupid questions is you definitely shouldn't be afraid to ask questions, especially in these situations, because everybody's always going to get stuck. I think this is even more true in remote teams, because sometimes you feel like, I'm afraid to ping this important person because what if they're in some important sales meeting and deciding the fate of the business or whatever. And you probably shouldn't necessarily ping those people with trivial questions. But also, if you are blocked, if you cannot perform your job because of something, you should be reaching out in some capacity, because you're not doing anybody any good if you can't figure out whatever situation you're in, if there's somebody that can help. As long as you've done your due diligence that we talked about earlier, absolutely speak up. You don't want to be just sitting around blocked for days at a time. Hours,
right.
Yep.
And that's actually a perfect segue, TJ, for the next next point, which you're is to just be nice.
Yes.
You know, this is huge, but don't come into a new company and hate everything that they've ever written. And you know, just be that person who's like, why did you do it this way? Why is this data so bad? Why is this structure not well? Well, my team didn't do it that way. Don't be that person. Be that person who assume that you know nothing, that there is legacy code, that this company has been around for some amount of time before you got here, and they were doing the best they could with what they had, and try and make it better. But don't be that person who just hates everything and is like, this is a terrible idea. I don't know why anybody would do this. And just because it'll get you so much further if you ask questions like, why was this built this way? Try to understand those reasons. And then try and make it better, because that's what you were hired to do anyway. So just be likable.
I think the only consistency throughout every job I've ever had is that the previous developer was always the worst. It's like, no matter what, because it's so easy to pass blame on, well, why is this code so slow, or why can't we make changes fast enough? It's like, well, when whoever was here before, they architected it this way. We don't know why, right? Especially if that person's no longer with the company. Oh, man, then it's free reign on this person, right?
Never,
like they...
They're never with the company.
Yeah, exactly. That they made the absolute worst architectural decisions, and like nobody understands it, but our next refactor is going to totally fix it, though, so...
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, you... Over time, to get into, like, this, what senior developers know is that code is full of trade-offs and it's full of strange requirements. And if you see some strange thing that's happening in the code, chances are it's not because somebody purposely designed it this way to be slow or hard to read or whatever, but they had some business requirement and maybe they documented this really well. You know, maybe they didn't. Maybe comments and meetings were kind of lost to time, but... Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes requirements come in, things happen over time. A lot of the apps that we work on are very complex. There's lots of moving pieces. There's lots of people involved, and it can be a mess. So I agree with your words. Just try to be kind and considerate. There were humans that were building this that probably had the best intentions in mind and were trying to design something that could be used well. Mm-hmm. Very often, I mean, it's been very rare in my career that I've encountered someone that was truly a not nice person or was truly trying to be like acting in bad faith. Those people are few and far between. Like most people are trying to just go about their day, get the job solved, ship some usable software and go on with their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody who's been in the business for, I don't know, more than a couple minutes is going to tell you they'd rather work with somebody who's competent and nice, easy to work with, just a nice person, personable, versus an insanely super talented person who's just a complete jerk. Like, you'd be 10x good. Yeah. But if you're also like 10x at bringing the team down and making everybody else feel like rubbish. Mm-hmm. And that's not fun. That's not fun to be around. It's not fun to manage. It's not fun to lead. It's not just, I've definitely worked, unfortunately, once or twice in an environment where you had like a lead engineer who was just like
a diva.
Yes. And the product was never all that great because basically everybody was like, you know, kind of betas to his alpha. And it was just not fun. Nobody learns anything. Everybody's getting pounded every day. It's not
great. It never goes well. You know, that definitely brings down team morale. And there's so few jobs nowadays, I think, even in development, where you're going to be the only developer. So you can make all those choices and feel superior and do all that stuff. Because unless you're building some very small thing or you're a startup of one, you're going to be working with people in a team. Yeah. So it's a lot easier when you're nice and everybody gets along and can feel like they're in a safe space to ask questions and make mistakes and try stuff that might not work than it is to be afraid of trying anything because they're going to get their head bitten off if they do.
Exactly.
So true. So true.
All right. Well, I can take I'm looking for clever segues, but I can take the next one. I think my next sort of pick along these lines. My next one is that I think specialization is kind of important and that it's really good to be a specialist or to be really good in terms of trade-offs. I'd rather be really good at something than kind of good at a whole lot of things. And this there's kind of some gray area here because you definitely want to, you don't want somebody that just knows like one facet of an app or technology really well and is completely oblivious around everything else. But I find that having specialized skills can be really important in terms of things like career advancement, having something that you are kind of really well known for. If you think about popular names you know throughout the software development world, chances are you know them because they're really good at something, right? Mm-hmm. Like whether they're a CSS expert, they know the JavaScript language really good. They know Webpack really good. I feel like being the knowledgeable person about something can be important for just your company getting stuff done. And it can also be important for you personally about being the person that specializes in something. So like I said, there's some gray area. That doesn't mean like I think you should only focus on one thing, because to be a software developer, you kind of have to know a whole bunch of things. But I wouldn't shy away from having the one thing, something you really like. Really knowing it.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the important part.
Something you wouldn't mind necessarily waking up at 2 a.m. to deal with, like Webpack at 2 a.m. Can you deal with that? You know, kind of thing.
Well, the thing is, too, if it's not something you like, you'll never actually, you won't be motivated to learn what you need to become a specialist. So if there is something you like, you know, consider really doubling down and just making that sort of your thing, because I think there's a lot of potential for doing that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times I think for more junior positions, they really try to stress full stack as being the thing that they're looking for. So they want you to be able to do front end and back end and maybe database stuff a little bit. And that's great. I understand that. It's good to get exposure, like TJ said, to kind of the whole process of building an application. And it's very beneficial early in your career to at least get to try all of those different things. But as time goes on, you'll probably notice that you gravitate more towards something than others. Maybe you really like building pipelines and seeing continuous integration stuff. Maybe you're really big into front-end technologies and you love React. Maybe, you know, databases are your thing. So it is very good to have experience, but then I think, like he said, if you can find something that you really just enjoy doing more or kind of go towards, if there's a ticket for that, you pick it up, try and be better at that than basically everybody else that you work with. Try to be that person that they come to when they're having trouble and they're stuck and their flex box isn't working or their grade just won't align.
Yeah.
Because not only does it make you a really good and valuable member of the team because you just kind of know that stuff, but you'll probably also be happy to sit down and work it out with them or teach them how to do it or, you know, take a pass at it or something like that, which just helps the team move forward, teaches somebody something new, and makes you look really good because you're like getting in there and helping and unblocking people, which is always a huge thing.
Hey, folks, I'm here with JD from Raygun. JD, I have to complain. I mean, when I started in tech like 20 years ago, one of the first things they taught me was to use tail and grep to find the problem on a server. And I don't do that anymore. I have to say Raygun kind of solves that problem for me and picks up all the stuff that really is relevant to the request or whatever that came in. I'm curious, do you find that with kind of the oldsters like me a common thing? Or
I think there's definitely better approaches to solving some of these problems now. You know, I always used to think of logging. I heard this great analogy once. It was like, you know, logging tools are like coffins. Things go in there. They very rarely come out, you know. True. And you feel safe because it's there, but there's so much noise. Understanding what's mm-hmm. important and what's not takes a lot of effort. And I mean, you know, often I talk about Raygun's crash reporting product as being like a black box flight recorder. Like, just tell me when the plane blows up because I need to fix that really urgently, you know. And that's been hugely valuable. You don't need to tail that.
That's true. You know, folks, you should just go get Raygun and then you can see when stuff breaks, what matters. You can get it at raygun.com. They actually are doing a free trial, so go check it out.
Yeah, and the level of how much specifying. So I'm not necessarily saying you should be the expert on like CSS variables or something really. although if that's your thing, you know, don't let me stop you. I even mean, like, for me, it was, I worked out of college. The very first job I had was one that very much encouraged you to do a little bit of everything. So I did front end stuff. I did back end stuff. I did database stuff. I did a little bit of everything. And I found that out of all of those things, the stuff I liked working on the most was front end stuff. And mm-hmm. eventually that led me to just getting good at JavaScript. And eventually that led to jobs that were front end focused. So that was all I did. And I found that I was happier doing things like that. I had more opportunities doing things like that. So it doesn't have to be just like really niche. It could just be like focusing on a type of development you really like and spending your time there if that's what you like doing.
Mm-hmm. And kind of bring this back into the realm of the practical, because we are React Roundup. I would say hooks. Every team needs somebody on the team who really, really, really understands hooks and dependency array, things like if that.
And if you're that person, I'll drop my email in the show notes. You can reach out.
There's so many folks who have issues with, you know, why doesn't this use effect work? Blah, 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 blah. Oh my gosh. Okay, and that, like, so what else is there? I would say auth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's so hard.
Routing, another big one. Everybody needs every team needs.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
I know. You've always been looking for a way to support the React Roundup podcast. Well, you're in luck. We just set it up. It's reactroundup.com/premium. And all you have to do is go over there. You pay us $9 a month, and you'll get access to a couple of things. The first thing is you will get episodes with no ads. Won't that be nice? You will also get access to a monthly call where we sit down and we plan out what we want to talk about for the next several months. And you can give us ideas for questions and other things that we can ask our guests that are coming up. So you'll know what episodes are coming up and what we're going to be talking about and have some feedback there, which is awesome. And finally, it's a terrific way to support the show. So if you want to support us in putting out React Roundup every month, go to reactroundup.com/premium and sign up.
Whoever is going to understand the React router or whatever you're using. And then whatever your chosen statement is, assuming your state management isn't with hooks, then whatever that is, like your Redux person on a lot of teams or your MobX person or whatever, you know, somebody who's kind of, I guess, not often isn't an official role. It's just like, that's the person that you go to, or that's the person who's really going to look the PR. Like, oh, okay. Have you modeled that the right way? Oh, wait, hold on. We already had that piece of data. It's over here. You just didn't go find it, kind of thing. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we've got one guy on our team who's definitely like the GitHub Action CI/CD person. It's like, if you need to set up a new pipeline or get anything running, this is the person that you turn to and ask them to do it, because he'll do it in half the time it would take the rest of us.
Yeah, and it turns out that's a really handy skill to have around, like things like that. Like yes. You'll notice too that the stuff that, especially like if you can get good at one of these like harder niche problems, like you'll find yourself to be an invaluable asset. Like if mm-hmm. If they have an auth expert or a hooks expert, like, man, that's just going to be a gift that keeps giving just in terms of the value to the company or just to yourself personally.
And there's so much people worry about, well, yeah, obviously imposter syndrome and also, you know, getting layoffs and things like that and not being laid off. Having that sense of I am the so-and-so on the team and they need me for this role, that can give you a lot of sense of I have a stable, you know, job here. And then when you're going through other interviews and talking to other companies, they're like, okay, you know, I was on the team and I handle all kinds of bugs, but I did have this specialty around this. And maybe they'll ask you questions in that area and maybe you'll be their person, you know, and the kind of person where when you're talking about at the end of the interview cycle, like, ooh, do we want that person? Oh, yeah. You know, he knows that. Hey, but I have a segue. Okay, you ready for this? So this segues nicely into take code reviews really seriously. Mm-hmm. So PRs, people overlook them. It's like, oh, I'm at the end of the day. I need to get this thing out the door. You know, I'm just going to like approve. Mm-hmm. You know, companies like this, teams, like as a cultural thing, they often, the good teams will take code reviews really seriously, right? And you should spend, you know, a good percentage of your time in the code review, and I would say also and adding really good value to it, making sure and try it one, and then from people creating code reviews, keep the code change small, you know, don't the 80 file commits, man, really? Oh. Please stop.
No.
right? And then the other thing is, and I think we talked about this, like just at the beginning, you're going to get really smushed on these code reviews because you're going to come in, it's, you know, the style that you use in code school isn't going to be what you're going to do here, that sort of stuff. So understand that that's probably going to happen and don't take it personally, right? They're just trying to get you on the team. It's like getting a text, you know, you're not like, there's a lot of context lost. Maybe they're trying to be funny in the text, in the comment, but it doesn't come off as funny because it's in text. Don't take it personally. Like the first couple code reviews are going
to be. Yeah. And one thing that I would say to kind of add on to that, and I didn't really experience it with my first team, but I have with the team that I'm currently with, is that a lot of times, not only will whoever is reviewing the code point out things that they think could be improved or, you know, little typos or things like that, but they'll also point out things that they really liked about the code. And I think that that is super important and something that we should try and do as reviewers all the time. Like I see some really smart code or some, you know, nice thing that fixes some little issue or something. And I love giving, you know, thumbs up or clapping hands or all sorts of different stuff, because it's really good when people do that. And it feels really nice when people are like, yes, I could not figure that thing out. You went and fixed it. Good job. You know, that's also a huge part of it. It shouldn't just be, this is wrong, fix it. It should also be, that was a really nice way that you solved that problem.
Yeah, I've never seen that before. That was great. Yeah. Have you heard of the sandwich technique?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so the idea.
I have not. So you should define this.
All right. Okay. Here we go. So it's you give. I mean, think about it like a sandwich. So you give good news, bad news, good news.
Right?
This PR. Wow. It really solves the thing that we wanted you to solve, you know, whatever, however flowery you want to get it. But then, like, right in the middle, it's like, but we don't really do it that way. And then, you know, kind of come in at the end and say, again, just want to reiterate, beautiful, well played, well thought out, trying to find something good in it. And so, you know, people just like that. You know, they don't, if you just come at them with the bad news, you know, you got to sandwich it.
Yeah. Another thing I like to do too, when I am on the reviewing side of PRs, is I try to differentiate between things that I have that are just like suggestions or sort of comments versus things that I think are actually like important. So like, I might just say as a suggestion, like you might want to consider refactoring this, so this isn't dependent on this or whatever. Because Because sometimes you can also realize, like, you can get very pedantic on these sort of PRs, which can cost real time, right? Because sometimes things that you might like to be a different style or work a different way are also things that aren't going to cause any actual issues that you don't necessarily want to cause somebody to spend hours refactoring just to do it. sometimes by leaving those suggestions, the other person will think like, oh, wow, that really is actually better. I think I could do some things. So I like leaving those comments, but just making it clear like, hey, this is just a suggestion. You can take or leave this, right? I'm just going to toss this out here versus something you see that's like, okay, this is going to cause a bug or like, this is clearly like a problem. This is going to create real issues. Like, make sure to specify that as well, right? Like, this is an actual important thing to fix, because I think differentiating between the two makes your PR comments a lot easier to read through, to see like, okay, what are the important things versus the kind of trivial things. So I try to do that as well, because I've found when other people have done that for me, it's been helpful as well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it may be that it's a really good suggestion, but it's just too big in the scope of whatever it is you're working on. So maybe you throw another chore in the backlog afterwards and be like, this was great, but it just didn't make sense in the PR that I was submitting.
Yeah. Like maybe like this, I love this change, but when we do, but if we introduce this, it doesn't look so great on mobile. Let's create a ticket to address mm-hmm. this or something like that, because I don't think it makes sense to do now. So, you know, something like that, you run into those sorts of things all the time.
Yeah. And that's actually a really good one to kind of piggyback off, which is don't get too attached to your code.
Oh,
and this
gosh.
Is something that happens. Yeah. It definitely happens to us all. We're really proud of something. It took us, you know, however long to write this insanely complex XYZ. And then somebody, either product or users or someone, is like, we need to refactor this whole thing. Get rid of this code. Scrap it. And it feels awful in the moment, but it's for the benefit of your users. It's for the benefit of the code base. There's some reason that we're getting rid of this code, and it shouldn't be taken personally.
Yeah. In general too, in software development, this is more like a product manager type thing, but usually you try to design features like that so that they can be tested and experimented with before you throw, like, or you try to design something so that you can see if there's user interest before you really, really commit to it, right? Yeah. Like maybe ship a small part of it, then check your analytics. Are people using this? Are they engaging with this before we add 27 different ways to filter or graph this data, right? Like, let's make sure people actually, people actually want this first, so that hopefully, because I find lots of times one reason you get so attached to your code is just the sheer amount of effort you put into it. Because if it's like anything that you worked on for a year, if I work on anything for a year, I'm going to feel some sense of wanting to see that have some value. None of us want our lives to feel pointless, right? If I spent a year on my keyboard typing something up, I want it to actually go off and do something useful for people. So as like a, from a PM perspective, you want to try to make sure people don't get put into those sort of situations too, where you kind of make sure that you're shipping incrementally, making sure stuff is actually useful, going to be used, that sort of thing as well.
I think there's a good story online of like, I think it was Etsy that did, they were the ones who really got into like A/B testing first off, because they spent like 6 months building Infinite Scroll and building all the API support, blah, 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 blah. And then it went out and you were like, engagement went down.
Users didn't like it.
We just blew it, and we blew it for like the entire company. And so they ended up going with exactly what you're saying, which is like always like making the most minute changes and then seeing, is this the right thing to do? Is this increased engagement or whatever, you know, their metric was, you know, obviously conversions, I'm guessing. Yeah, but very small changes.
Unfortunately, I have a story along these same lines as well. The insurance company that I worked with right out of college, big insurance company, at the time they had decided, when I first started working there, public internet quoting was just starting to become a thing. So Progressive was just starting to run commercials. You can get an auto quote online, which was a big deal back, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago sort of thing. And my company, being like an older enterprisey company, decided, well, we need a system like this too, right? Because if Progressive can do it, if Geico can do it, we need one of these as well. And so I was on a team that spent over a year building one of these systems. We built it just for one state. And at the very end of this, we deployed this. It went out to production. The company decided that the public quoting model was just not a good idea. It was just a failed premise. Like, that's the thing that made them unique, was that they're not a competitor to Progressive or Geico, and they couldn't actually compete with things like that. So it was all just a big, the code base was, I've learned, I left that company, but I've learned that code is completely deleted as like within like a year or so of me leaving. And so it does feel like it's easy to say you shouldn't feel any like commitment to your code, but like when you go through a process like that, you really feel it, right? Because you like, I put a lot of work into that. Like, yeah, you kind of want to see it do something. Yeah, right. So totally. It gets frustrating when you go through things like that.
Oh, completely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think if you have zero interest in the code, it's really hard to wake up in the morning and want to write it.
Right.
Yeah.
And everybody's going to have those days where whatever you're working on is just not really exciting to you. But if that's every day and you really just dread working on a project, then you probably need to start thinking about finding a new team, a new project, something to get you excited again.
Yep.
DJ, you got a great segue for us?
I don't have a great segue, but maybe I do. I don't know. All I feel like this is a tip that might be a good one that's worth ending on, because I feel like it's a constant theme that we've had on this show, and that's that the code isn't always the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in junior development, you kind of get this sense, especially if you go through things like coding boot camps and stuff, that the way to get ahead in coding is to be the person that's the best at React syntax, or the person who knows like the way that these algorithms work the best. And that stuff is important, but there's a lot of other stuff that's important to being a software developer as well, that can get into more architectural things, but that can even just get into life skills, just being really good at dealing with people, being able to write, being able to read really, really well, being aware of what's going on in the programming world, events, mm-hmm. which technologies are up and coming, how to evaluate different technologies. Lots of things like that are in many cases, more important than knowing the syntax for how React hooks work or things like that. And I think it helped tend you get farther in your career, and also to just be a more valuable person in terms of just being a software developer throughout your career.
That was the most consistent piece of feedback I got in the video, was learn the business domain. You know, learn what you're getting into. Yes. If you're getting into, I'm in DNA stuff currently, and I'm kind of like learning that as I go. And one, it's fascinating, which is great. But two, there's just so much when the product manager says, you know, we need to do X, Y, and Z, if they need to like really get in, like, it's just hard to really be able to construct a design, a model for something, unless you actually know, like, oh, this could be, like, if they have to go through every single detail, like, oh, this thing could have 8 values, or this thing could have 2, you should just know that, right? And so you don't have to know that coming in, but, like, keep an open mind, be curious about what the features are that you're building, try the product out, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah, it's one thing to come to work every day and just pick up the next story in the backlog and work on it. But if you can actually understand the value that it's bringing to the product that you're building or the users who are using it, or even ask questions and make suggestions for how it could be improved, that is so incredibly valuable to the company, to the team, to everybody. And I think it's something that is really we don't talk about it. You just kind of start to get a feel for it as you're at with a team longer and as you're have a better understanding of the business that you're in. But if you can do that early on and start to understand what is the bigger problem that I'm trying to solve for my users and how is my application going to help do that, I think you'll be able to bring a lot of value a lot faster. Wow, really had a moment there. But you'll be able to bring a lot of value faster to the team and hopefully improve, you know, whatever it is that you're building and make an even better experience for your users. So that's a huge one.
Yeah. And the product manager, a filter of a sort, they're probably thinking, oh, that would be hard to implement. and this will be easy to implement. I don't think I've ever seen it, that line up anytime. It's like anything that they think is going to be easy to implement is always the hardest thing. It's like that involves AI, you know, what, you know, or anything that they think is going to be insanely difficult. Like that filter. It's like, no, that's like a 2-minute job to add a filter. Like that's built into the table, you know. Kind of.
No, I really like the domain knowledge point. It's super interesting because just to give one concrete example of this, Paige and I both work in an IoT world today. And one of the things Blues does is it sends out hardware to most everybody that works there to try and to tinker with. Yeah. And Paige and I are not electrical engineers. We are nowhere close to that. But I feel like even just the act of setting some of these things up and using them has helped inform a lot of the decisions we make when actually writing code, because you run into things like my stuff, like I have trouble powering these stupid things on all the time, right? So I've realized when I build a dashboard, like seeing the battery, the voltage and stuff is actually kind of important, right? Or like getting like alerts when the battery is low, because I've hit these sort of problems myself, right? Yeah. So just little things you learn can help inform the decisions and how you think about the things that you are building. So I'll definitely plus one to your commenters. That's super important knowledge to have.
In fact, you're the most ideally suited to bring that to the team, because any of it, maybe the other folks on the team are veterans of IoT and like they don't ever have battery problems because they know to whatever charge up or not or whatever it is, right? But you have unique insight because you can represent the person who is just getting into IoT because that's you.
Yeah. Yep. It's a valuable position to be in when you're new to anything, because you can bring that really good outside perspective that you have, you know, no prior preconceived notions, no prior experience, which is really valuable to any team, because we get so into our code bases and our products and whatever that things, quirks that you don't even think about as a seasoned developer, somebody else will hit and ask, why is it like this? And that may be a great, you know, reason to fix it or change it or do something that would help improve everybody's experience.
The hidden value of being an imposter.
Yes.
Right? Everybody thinks it's a bad thing. It's actually a good thing in some way.
That needs to be the title of your next YouTube video.
Yeah.
Jack.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
not bad. Let's think about that one.
I just picturing the YouTube thumbnail, right? You've got the like cloak over your face or whatever. Like,
yeah, exactly. How to not beat imposter syndrome, how to embrace imposter syndrome. Exactly.
Hi, this is Charles Maxwood from Top End Devs. And lately I've been coaching some people on starting some podcasts and in some cases just taking their career to the next level. You know, whether you're beginner going to intermediate going to advanced, whether you're trying to get noticed in the community or go freelance, I've been helping these folks figure out how to get in front of people, how to build relationships and how to build their careers and max out and just go to the next level. So if you're interested in talking to me and having me help you go to the next level, go to topenddevs.com/coaching. I will give you a 1-hour free session where we can figure out what you're trying to do, where you're trying to go, and figure out what the next steps are. And then from there, we can figure out how to get you to the place you want to go. So once again, that's topenddevs.com/coaching.
Okay. Well, you mentioned it before. Let's do our picks. Paige, you want to start us off with some picks?
Sure. So a lot of good stuff has been coming out on Netflix and streaming services recently. And the pick that I'm going to go with is what I've been watching most recently, which is the second season of Bridgerton on Netflix. So if you're not familiar with it, I think it's based on a book series, which I have not read, but I'm planning to buy because I enjoyed the series, the show so much. But it's like a perfect Gilded Age of England, but even better because it's not really based on true stories. It's just set in this picturesque English London kind of setting. And everybody is super rich and the costumes are ridiculous and everybody is really good looking. And it's... So it's really fun because it's very romance driven, but there's also, you know, sword fights and carriage shootouts and people racing around on horses. So there's a little bit of something for everyone. So if you're looking for kind of a Gilded Age escapist type of thing, I would say that it's definitely worth a watch.
My wife is a big fan and she says the books are really good for what it's worth. Nice. So
that's awesome. Yeah, I'm definitely going to be picking those up.
my wife is also a big fan, and I, you know, my office is near the TV room, and so I walk past it and I'll see, like, you know, this it's gorgeous. Like, it's just, I mean, oh my God, like the colors are so vibrant, and the costume, it's just, it's brilliant. And, you know, it's, like, I often whinge about how bad, like, TV has gotten in terms of, like, being dark. Like, you just can't see things.
Yeah.
Like, Bridgerton is, like, the absolute opposite of that. It will use every single RGB value your TV can put out and more.
Yes.
No, it's funny that you say that, too, because I'm the same way. My wife will have it on, and I won't know, like, the greater plot or anything, but I can totally get sucked into watching for 5 or 10 minutes here or there because it's just so gorgeous.
Right. The people, exactly.
The people, like, the scenery, the costumes,
everything's gorgeous. It's just perfect. And you're like,
yeah.
Okay. That's great. All right, TJ, you got a good pick for us?
My pick is going to be children's museums, or I guess specifically if you are in Michigan, I'll pick the Ann Arbor Hands-On Museum for if you happen to be close to it. But we've actually got a good one here in Lansing, too, called Impression 5. But these museums are kind of fun, both, I mean, especially if you have kids, that's sort of the idea. But even for adults, they can be a lot of fun. Maybe rent somebody else's kid, like a nephew or a friend or something like that, if you feel embarrassed to go by yourself. But I just sort of get fascinated by the engineering that goes into some of these contraptions that they put together. The one in Ann Arbor had one that was trying to demonstrate how packets work, like computer, like how it divides bytes up into packets. And it had this visualization where it had a world map up on the wall, and it had balls that started in a pattern and then moved around the world. These balls, like, physically traveled between these spots in the map, but would always end up on the other end in the same order that they started with, despite them taking these different paths. And I was just sort of
absolutely
enthralled by this. Like, my wife was, like, dragging me out of this. My kids were probably dragging me out of the place as well. That it's so cool. They had a hamster wheel, like, that you could actually, like, run on, like, a human sized one. Yeah. They had some, like, plaques or whatever to explain some of the science behind what it was doing and stuff. But, or you could just run on a wheel and just have fun, fun doing that as well. So if you have something like that in your area, I'd recommend checking it out.
Absolutely. If you're in the Bay Area, there's the Exploratorium. And then I think up here in Portland, there's OMSI, Science and Industry Museum, Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. Very good. It's also got one of those kind of exploratory rooms.
Is that the one by there's something by the zoo in Portland, isn't there? Because I actually took my kids there years ago.
And there's a literal, like, part of the exhibitory. I'm not sure whether it's exactly associated with it. It's a nuclear submarine.
Ooh.
Like, literally, like, right on the water. One of these days I'll go on to the submarine. I that's one of those things. I think COVID happened. I mean, kind of ruined my submarine idea.
Yeah. If you're in the St. Louis area where I grew up, there's a ton. There's the Science Center, which is free. There is the Magic House, which is awesome for younger kids because it's just this house that expands and expands.
Ooh,
it's got all kinds of cool stuff, exactly like TJ is talking about. And then there's also one that's more, it's less scientific. It's more just really fun. And it's called the City Museum. And it's like a 5-story building that they've turned into this indoor, outdoor kind of exploratorium, I guess is the best way to describe it. You know, you can walk into a whale and then suddenly you're climbing through the rafters, and it's super fun. So yeah, those things are the best.
I want to take a whole summer and just go around the country and go to all these places, you know.
It'd be so just fun.
So cool. You're right. It is, like, the way that they make the exhibits is almost more is as interesting as the exhibits themselves sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, how they visualize it and all that. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to do a technical thing for my pick. And that's actually, I'm on the side kind of a Rails person. I've been a Rails person for, like, a long time, since Rails 1. And they just came out with, not sure if they just came out with it or just whatever. Hotwire is out. And it's a very interesting thing, I think, from the angle of a React developer looking at this technology, which is essentially around trying to do dynamic behavior on the browser without actually adding any JavaScript. Or without writing your own JavaScript, I will say. There's a lot of JavaScript involved. There's 78K of JavaScript on the page to make this happen. But none of it is JavaScript you have to write. And it's actually really fascinating. And I think as a developer, sometimes we think too much about, like, you know, how to get really good at React. And then we don't realize that, like, React is one vein of thought about how to deal with a browser. Like, there is Remix, which is doing, like, the kind of form posting stuff that we used to do 5-10 years ago. And if you haven't had an experience, and for a lot of React devs, they will have never seen that. And that's really good to learn, because I think there's a decent percentage chance that we will go back to that. And then this is another way, like looking at the world, like, okay, so how do the Rails folks think about the world? Maybe there's something that I can take from that as an idea and how to architect my React apps in a way that doesn't necessarily feel like our usual, like, post some JSON, get some JSON back, render it, blah, 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 blah. You know, that sort of thing. So anyway, something good to look at and to stretch your skills as an engineer.
Nice.
Good stuff.
All right. Well, this is a blast. I always love these panelist episodes. So much fun, yeah, just hanging with you guys and just talking about stuff.
Yeah. Great.
All right. Well, we will see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
See you then.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.